It's Friday, July 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the United States and China slap billions of dollars of tariffs on each other's exports. A Thai diver dies while trying to assist a football team and its coach trapped in a flooded cave.
They're saying that he had a lack of oxygen, and then he passed out and they couldn't resuscitate him.
And new treatments give hope to people with brain tumors. It's all ahead. China said Friday it was forced to take a necessary counterattack and responded in kind to the United States after Washington placed tariffs on 800 Chinese import products valued at $34 billion. China's state-run Xinhua News Agency reports China applied retaliatory tariffs on 545 U.S. items, also worth $34 billion, including agricultural products, vehicles, and aquatic products. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Liu Kang said China is completely justified in its response to the U.S. tariffs, which he said will disturb the global trade order, cause turbulence on the global market, and hamper world economic recovery, according to Chinese broadcaster CCTV. Commerce Ministry spokesman Gao Feng this week warned the tariffs will hit international supply chains, including foreign companies doing business in China. In an editorial, the state-run Global Times said China must prepare itself for a new American effort in containment, and Chinese society should brace itself for major changes in Sino-U.S. relations. Scott Kennedy is director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Centers for Strategic and International Studies. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty both sides believe they hold the moral high ground.
Even though the Chinese haven't fired the first shot in terms of tariffs, they are already making life difficult for American companies in China. So they are at least, if not firing the first shot, already pulled out some of the knives.
The whole idea is, of course, open and free trade, but the Trump administration insists this is not fair trade. They cite intellectual property theft or forced technology transfer, if you will, and also a lack of market access in China. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think there's a consensus in Washington and other Western capitals, China's trading partners, that doing business with China is very difficult, that Chinese industrial policy has ramped up and that it's difficult to sell in China if you're a foreign company. The demands for technology sharing are quite high, and China has other ways, legal and illegal, to gain technology. So I think no one has a big beef, at least in the West, with the Trump administration's diagnosis of the challenge. The question is on the prescription, what to do about it. And there's obviously no consensus. And we're in the early stages of a trade war that not everyone agrees we should be in.
There are some who argue that China has already been engaged in a trade war with the U.S., and the U.S. is just now responding.
Yes, Chinese industrial policy has been ongoing for a long time, and the ambition, organization, amount of funding they're putting toward it has expanded recently. And this is certainly, makes the playing field uneven. The U.S. has tried responding in a variety of different ways, mostly through bilateral talks with the Chinese, WTO cases, and that really hasn't gotten the U.S. anywhere. And so everyone feels frustrated and wants to try something new. The question is, bringing tariffs unilaterally against China with no other country supporting us in that effort, is that likely to succeed? Because the goal isn't just simply to vent. The goal is to make things fair. And when you're facing a rival like China, you have to do things smartly, not just be tough about things.
Is China showing any signs of compromise?
China has certainly indicated that they want to gradually liberalize parts of their economy, open up investment more, and they've made announcements over the last couple months of things that they've done and plan to do. But on the very big questions, broadly speaking, the Chinese have been clear that they're not going to stop implementing Made in China 2025 or limit the role of the state in the economy in general. And so, broadly speaking, the two sides are really at loggerheads and don't seem to want to back down right now. We'll just see what the consequences are economically and politically for both sides.
Scott Kennedy said economically, China is at a disadvantage because it's a smaller economy than the U.S. But politically, he said Chinese President Xi Jinping has the upper hand by controlling both the political system and the media. He expects President Donald Trump will feel the political heat to seek compromise first. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Turkey condemns U.S. sanctions against Iran. Former Pakistani Prime Minister has been sentenced to 10, Nawaz Sharif, rather, has been sentenced to 10 years in prison. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo talks with North Korean officials in Pyongyang. And a MiG-29 military jet crashes in Poland, killing the pilot. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers found evidence of a cataclysmic collision between the Milky Way and a dwarf galaxy some 8 to 10 billion years ago. The astronomers refer to this cosmic crash as a defining event in the early history of the Milky Way. They say the collision between our galaxy and what is being called the Sausage Galaxy reshaped the actual structure of the Milky Way, helping to form the galaxy's inner bulge and outer halo. According to one of the lead researchers, Vasily Belikurov of England's University of Cambridge and New York's Flatiron Institute, the cosmic collision ripped the dwarf galaxy to shreds, with its stars moving in orbits that are long and narrow like needles. Since the astronomers used data from the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite to make their findings, they're calling the paths of the stars from the former dwarf galaxy the Gaia Sausage. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the chief of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, resigns. Thai authorities say there's a limited amount of time to get the 12 boys and their soccer coach out of a flooded cave in northern Thailand, and they cite worsening weather and a dwindling underground air supply. The major operation inside and around Tam Luang Nan Nong Cave suffered its first death Friday when a former Thai Navy SEAL passed out underwater and could not be revived. Reporter Steve Sanford is near the cave on the Thai border with Myanmar. He tells me about Friday's fatality.
This morning, an ex-Thai Navy SEAL died on the way out of the last chamber, which is the most difficult chamber to get out of. That's where they have to get the 12 kids and the coach through that cavern of rocks and crevices and a lot of water. And basically, a 38-year-old ex-Thai Navy SEAL, he had retired from the SEAL outfit, but he had come back to help out. And he had, what they say, on the way out of the cavern, he had brought in supplies. And on the way out, he died. They're saying that he had a lack of oxygen, and then he passed out, and they couldn't resuscitate him. So right now, with that situation as it is, everyone has to take a closer look at the potential of getting these kids out after someone who's as skilled as this Thai Navy SEAL officer is, he died. So there's a lot of concern, but there's a rain coming soon. The rain is expected this weekend. So that will definitely make the rescue operations more drastic to get completed before too much water gets into the cave.
What about the efforts to pump the water out of the cave? How has that been going?
Well, that's been going pretty good. They've got quite a few pumps in the area getting the water out. But the biggest problem is there's a lot of limestone, and it soaks in the water, and there's a lot of runoffs from the mountainside to run into the cave as well. So, yeah, it's quite a difficult situation getting it pumped out. I guess if they had more technology that could get more water out, and I think that would be possible, that could be one approach to getting them out safely. I don't know how many more pumps they would need, though. It's very difficult right now. But yeah, they have proposed to train the kids. You know, they've been feeding them, they've been giving them some medical treatment, and now they need to train them so that they can safely get out of the caves. But again, with the death of this Thai Navy SEAL, there's a lot of doubt, a lot of questions as to if they will be able to train these kids adequately enough so that they can get out of the caves.
How much is known about their physical condition? I have heard reports that they're, you know, they're tired or they're rather weak, which is not surprising considering what they've been through.
No, absolutely. I mean, it was surprising to see them in as good shape as they were in. A lot of people were expecting worse conditions. There were some rumors that the coach was in pretty, or the assistant coach was in pretty bad shape because he had been giving his food supplies to the kids. But I'm just not sure what exact conditions are medically speaking. I'm sure that they need a lot. They need to get a lot more food in them and, you know, bring their weight up. Because, you know, 10 days without food, quite a long time.
Steve Sanford reporting from Northern Thailand. Embattled Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt has resigned after fighting numerous scandals and alleged ethics violations. President Donald Trump told reporters on Air Force One there was no final straw that led to Pruitt's resignation. Trump declined to mention the controversy surrounding the man, who had been one of his most loyal cabinet members. Trump says Pruitt's deputy, Andrew Wheeler, will take over as acting EPA chief. International Edition's David Byrd speaks with Keith Gaby, a spokesperson for the Environmental Defense Fund. Byrd asked Gaby what the resignation means for environmental policy.
Well, it's long overdue. He is the subject of, I think, 19 separate federal investigations of his ethical behavior, his spending, and other actions in office. It is a record I can't ever remember being achieved by anyone in government. The fact that he lasted this long is pretty stunning. The problem is that his successor for now, the acting administrator, Andrew Wheeler, has the exact same agenda in terms of letting polluters do what they want, relaxing clean air regulations, allowing for more water pollution, limiting review of toxic chemicals. So you have a guy who's probably going to be more careful about the spectacular ethical problems, but he's going to be no less a danger to our environment.
Pruitt oversaw some things that the Trump administration put forth, like the rolling back of the borders of things like Bears Ears and Grand Escalante and other places. But also the man that is his replacement, Mr. Wheeler, is a former coal industry lobbyist. So do you think that there are more people kind of like Scott Pruitt that are just waiting to be appointed or waiting to be confirmed?
You're right. One of the things Pruitt did was he stacked the agency with lobbyists and people from industry who are going to carry on the same agenda as their former employers. You have somebody running the Chemical Safety Office who came directly from the chemical industry's lobbying arm. And the biggest example is Wheeler himself, who, as you said, was a coal lobbyist. He worked for Murray Energy, one of the most notorious companies in terms of violating health and safety and pollution rules. They sent a wish list to the Trump administration at the beginning, when the president was first sworn in, calling for rolling back all sorts of pollution safeguards and cutting EPA almost in half. And that was when Wheeler was paid to represent them. Now they actually have somebody running the agency who's going to carry out that agenda. So it's very disturbing. And Wheeler, because he was a lobbyist and congressional staffer, he knows how the bureaucratic machinery works, so he's likely to be more careful than Pruitt was in terms of his personal behavior, but he's also likely to know how to pull the levers. And that's really dangerous for Americans who are worried about clean air and clean water and toxic chemicals.
And this controversy around Pruitt and the identity of his replacement, Mr. Wheeler, comes at a time when you're seeing things like the Flint, Michigan lead in the water case, or you're seeing things like the pollution of plastics in the ocean or mercury in wildlife. What can the American people expect as far as Senate confirmation of a successor, first of all, and what does this bode for the November elections as far as you know, getting confirmation of a new EPA director will affect whether people vote Republican or Democratic?
One of the things that we've learned over time is that voters across the political spectrum, whether they're Democratic or Republican, care about clean air and clean water because it affects their children's health, it affects their children's future. People, you don't have a political party when it comes to getting asthma or cancer or any of these health problems from pollution. So it's very unpopular to attack these programs, and that's one of the reasons I doubt that President Trump is going to be able to get a new EPA administrator confirmed. His policies on the environment are among his least popular. He's not a very popular president, but he's even less popular on environmental issues. And you're going to have members of Congress in close swing districts running away from this record, because not only have you had Pruitt really shamelessly flouting ethical laws, he has done the bidding of industry. And it's just not the kind of thing, particularly swing voters in these suburban districts where a lot of these races are hottest, they won't put up with it. They don't want pollution in the air and the water, regardless of their ideology. And so I think we don't intervene directly in politics, but as an observer, it seems clearly like it's going to be a serious issue in the fall.
Keith Gaby is a spokesperson for the Environmental Defense Fund. He spoke with International Edition's David Byrd. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Next up, a conversation with Juan No Usadi, author of the book Of Monkey Bridges and Banh Mi Sandwiches, From Saigon to Texas, a poignant memoir of a girl and her family as they flee Vietnam to America in the 1980s. A heartwarming and often funny immigrant story. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Republican Senator John McCain is perhaps the best-known person with brain cancer. His is a glioblastoma, the most deadly type. The former presidential candidate announced the news last year. There's no cure, and even with treatment, most people with this type of cancer don't live longer than 3 years after the tumor is found. But scientists are experimenting with new treatments that show promise. VOA's Carol Pearson reports on some of the research that's giving people with brain tumors new hope.
Lori Mines was diagnosed with stage 4 brain cancer 2 years ago. She had a severe headache followed by a stroke. When doctors examined her, they found 2 large brain tumors, one on either side of her brain. She had surgery followed by radiation.
I didn't even want to know anything about it. I just basically wanted to be focused on trying to get better.
Even non-cancerous brain tumors can be deadly if they interfere with portions of the brain responsible for vital bodily functions. Treatment often includes surgery, chemotherapy, or radiation, or a combination of those. Glioblastomas are the most common form of cancerous brain tumors, and the 5-year relative survival rate is under 6%. That's the type of tumor Mines has.
I'm hoping that I will be here for longer, but I'm realistic too. It's glioblastoma. But I just keep fighting.
Scientists at Duke Health found they can increase the survival rate for some patients if they inject a modified poliovirus directly into the tumor. This is an example of targeted therapy. Other researchers are trying to get the body's own immune system to attack the tumors. Dr. Arnab Chakravati is with the Ohio State Comprehensive Cancer Center.
We're examining novel clinical trials, targeted therapies, immunotherapies, some of which look very promising right now. So there's a lot of hope for this patient population.
Chakravarti led a study on the genetic makeup of gliomas, a brain tumor that can be cancerous or benign. Mines was one of the participants. The researchers have found that they could more than double the life expectancy among patients who had a particular biomarker, a cell or molecule that's present with a particular type of tumor. It has helped doctors know what type of chemotherapy or radiation would work best to shrink the tumor.
It's very important to personalize care for the individual patient, and that's why biomarkers, prognostic and predictive biomarkers, are so important.
Experts say testing genetic markers will become the standard for patients with malignant brain tumors. They also are looking at targeted drug therapies as part of individualized treatment. The hope is that getting a diagnosis of brain cancer will no longer be an imminent death sentence. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the United States Department of State issues the Trafficking in Persons Report, or TIP report, which evaluates the anti-trafficking efforts of 187 countries and territories, including the United States. The report places them on one of four tiers, depending on government efforts in prosecuting traffickers, protecting victims, and preventing the crime. The theme of this year's TIP report is Local Solutions to a Global Problem, Supporting Communities in the Fight Against Human Trafficking. That's because local communities feel the impact and consequences of human trafficking most acutely, their stake in keeping their communities safe, as well as their familiarity with local trafficking trends, make them indispensable to the fight against modern slavery. With an estimated 25 million victims, human trafficking persists globally in defiance of all borders, said Acting Director of the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons, Carrie Johnstone, in a recent blog post. It is important to remember, however, that despite its pernicious global sweep, human trafficking happens in local communities, said Acting Director Johnstone. Traffickers operate with an innate understanding of the political, social, economic, and cultural contours of a local community. They exploit weaknesses in protection and take advantage of the hopes and fears of their victims. Addressing these issues can be difficult from a distance, so national governments should draw on the experience and know-how of local leaders, non-governmental organizations and advocates, and individual community members, all of whom have a sincere stake in seeing the end of human trafficking in the places they call home. By engaging in training law enforcement, religious leaders, teachers, tribal elders, business executives, and communities, we become more vigilant and learn to identify and address vulnerabilities swiftly. Proactive, community-driven measures strengthen our ability to protect our most vulnerable and weaken a criminal's ability to infiltrate, recruit, and exploit, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. If we're going to win this fight, national governments must empower local communities to proactively identify human trafficking and develop local solutions to address it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.